admit that I am neither an Alaska Native nor a biologist. So I'm not competent to talk about this very interesting subject from either the point of view of the Native community itself or from the point of view of what's good for the resources that are the object of all of this. The last thing I'd like to mention is that as I look around this table, at least those of us who live in Alaska, most but not all of us have engaged in hours and hours and hours of discussion about what the point of all this is and how best to accomplish whatever the point might be and what's been good and what's been bad. And we could continue to do that for days if, in fact, that's the drill. But it's my understanding that actually the point of this whole inquiry is what does all this have to do with the Native Claims Settlement Act? And so I will attempt ultimately to answer that question. And I think that it's a much easier question to answer than some of the questions that Gary has thrown out on the table. Starting with all of those ground rules in place, it seems to me that the first thing we could do is to try and very mechanically separate the issue. And when I look at the regulation of subsistence, whatever that means for the moment, it seems to me that it breaks down into three subjects: the use of the land, the regulation of Native people in terms of their taking a particular resource for the purpose of personal or local consumption, and then also, interestingly enough, the use by Alaska Natives of the very same resources in order to sort of shuffle the cards very quickly and, just like the rest of us, turn those resources into money. And I think that the use of subsistence resources by the Native community for access to the non-Native economy is a very interesting and overlooked part of this whole situation. So starting with that, I think it might be helpful in terms of looking at what ANCSA has done or not done to think about, again, in a very mechanical, non-Native sort of point of view, what the historical situation has been. And let's take primarily the regulation, at least for the moment, of the taking of fish and wildlife and other renewable resources by Alaska Natives for their own personal consumption, not to turn them into money. Well, as near as I've been able to figure it out, most of the members of the Native community who were wandering around Alaska prior to Mr. Bering and the rest of us descending upon them, in terms of how they spent their day, they were out essentially trying to corral animals and fish and stuff under their own control, and then attempting to turn what they had corralled into some kind of an economy. And if you think about it, and if you looked at it in terms of economic systems, it was an absolutely self-sufficient economy, right? You didn't have to send to Seattle for anything. You know, whether Sealand went on strike was completely unimportant, because theoretically everything that a family or a group of families needed to get through their day, they were getting themselves without having to go outside of their own situation to acquire whatever it is they needed. I mean, they were building homes out of tundra and driftwood. They were eating food that wandered by or swam by. They were clothing themselves with, at least as I understand it, with the skins of animals they probably caught for food. It was interesting looking at the E.W. Nelson exhibit that was at the Smithsonian last year. You know, even the toys and the things that kids did to get through the day were all things that the indigenous, what we would now call subsistence economy, could do for itself. Well, when the non-Native community descended on that system, obviously the non-Native community didn't much really like living here, which is why there were so few non-Natives around for so many years. And they were generally up here attempting to either gain access to the same resources that were used for the purposes I've just described, in order to turn those resources into money and then skedaddle, such as you know, the fisheries and the fur seals are an obvious example, and land-based fur animals and all of that. And when they were doing that, it certainly seemed to me that they had a tendency, at least the historical record would indicate, to slowly suck the native community into that economy. It is interesting to, you know, one of the most famous native events is the last traditional meeting of the Tanana chiefs when they met with Wickersham up in, was it Nanan or Fairbanks, I guess, in 1915. And it's interesting to look at that picture, because that picture depicts the leading men of the interior Alaska Native community who were down there to go cut a deal with the leading man of the non-Native community in Alaska. And if you look at the picture, you'll see that most of them are all wearing clothes that had to come out of Seattle. You know, I mean, that really started changing, even by 1915, the subsistence economy. And I would suggest that today that while the subsistence economy is important for some reasons that I will describe, I am becoming increasingly resistant to sort of the Rousseauian, for lack of a more respectful term, noble savage attitude about isn't the subsistence lifestyle great? I mean, it seemed to me, at least from what I've read about it, that it was an economy that was very marginal in terms of the wealth that it produced. And when it could not produce wealth on an ongoing basis, people died. I don't think that's very romantic, that if the food is there, it's great, and if the food's not there, people are dead. I don't think that anybody necessarily is interested to returning to that state of affairs, or at least that would be my value judgment as to what I suspect if people were given the two choices they would arrive at. But look, all that aside, looking at how this whole thing was regulated, although the Congress was obviously very interested in the fur seal situation and had a whole variety of laws dealing with what happens with fur seals, because that was really cash in the bank, there were very few laws dealing with game. And in 1902, it was not Alaskans and it was not the Alaska Native community, but it was a bunch of dilettante New York conservationists that decided that what Alaska really needed was a law that would tell all these people how to go about their business in order to protect all of these game resources. And it's interesting, however, to look at that law that was passed in 1902, which was the first game law that Alaska ever had. And it was interesting because they specifically wrote in an exemption to exempt Alaska Natives who were participating in that non-Native subsistence economy from having to pay the slightest bit of attention to whatever it is they were doing. And I think that that is a relatively interesting thing that was done, because I think the historical record will show that the Congress and the non-Native community that has decided over the last 50, 60, 70, 80 years to get in the business of attempting to regulate native behavior has really been pretty decent on a policy level at guaranteeing the Native community access, literal access, to whatever animals or fish might be around. That subsistence exemption reappeared in the 1908 game law. It reappeared in the 1925 game law. There are provisions that allow for people to take salmon for their own food requirements and for dog feed in the White Act, which was the major law that regulated the Alaska fishery before statehood. You look at the 41 Walrus Act, which attempted to control the walrus harvest in the Bering Sea, but provided a subsistence exemption. You look at the 56 Walrus Act. over and over and over, you'll see that Congress was pretty decent about guaranteeing the non-Native community access. In my judgment, the problem with that situation, or the problem with that benevolence, if you will, is that it wasn't the problem. The problem, when you're looking specifically at regulation, is not guaranteeing the Native community access. It is protecting the Native community's economic system from competition for access to the same resources. And with respect to that component of the regulatory process, I think the non-Native community, and in general, and the United States Congress in particular, failed miserably. And the reason they failed, I would suggest, is because the Native community packed neither weight politically nor economic power in the political world of the non-Native community that made those rules. So talk is cheap when you're just going to do something that will give the Native community access. But when you have to shut off someone else's access in order to do what's right by the Native community, that becomes a political question. And frankly, my reading of Alaskan history from 1902 until the present, actually, is that the Native community has not profited either by the benevolence of the non-Native legal system, nor has the non-Native community had the economic or political power to do a particularly good job of defending itself. I was going to say, I've probably irritated enough people that they've pulled the plug on me. Testing.
While we're waiting, Don, sure. Just a couple of things. You referred to that continuing subsistence exemption in federal laws enacted for many, many years. That was an exemption for Native subsistence, I take it.
Well, It depends on the law. The Alaska Game Acts protected not only natives but also non-natives who were out traveling or prospecting. You look at the walrus laws, and the walrus exemption was exclusively for Alaska natives. You look at even today, the exemption in the Marine Mammal Protection Act, that is exclusively for Alaska natives. So you look at the Endangered Species Act exemption, and that is both for Alaska natives and for non-natives, but only if they are residing in native villages. But you know, I think it is a pretty consistent thing that has a policy that you can trace without a lot of trouble. And I think that it was easy for that to be done because it was really cost-free. The non-native political system could do a nice thing like that and pat themselves on the back, and there wasn't anybody who would particularly get upset with them. Where it got tricky, as I said, is when there was a political problem associated with protecting the integrity of the native economic... Am I back on you? Okay, protecting the integrity of that economic system. And at that level, people failed miserably. And there are a couple of quick examples of that. One of the most interesting, I think, is that probably the most destructive thing that was done, well, actually, there's so many destructive things, it's hard to pick one. One of the most significantly destructive things that was done to the Native subsistence economic system was the decision that the only way that all those people down in California and Oregon and Washington were going to protect themselves from the Japanese was to haul about 8 trillion GIs up here in the early 1940s. And for those of you that aren't aware of that bit of history, there was a whole commotion about the Alaska game laws in those days said that in order to get a resident hunting license, you had to be domiciled here for a year. But of course, if you were up here in the armed services, you might be here a year, but you wouldn't be domiciled, you'd only be resident. And there was a whole commotion about that, and eventually the law was changed. But what's interesting is that If you look at the reports of the territorial governor from about that period of the change on up, you'll see particularly in the late 40s, early 50s, the territorial governor every single year almost, not every year, but almost every year, screaming and moaning to the Secretary of the Interior about how these 8 trillion GIs armed with M16s, or the equivalent for whatever it is they ran around with in those days, were shooting the bejesus out of everything that moved, and the territory was incapable of coping. They had no enforcement people, nobody was paying the slightest bit of attention to what was going on. It was trashing all the animals, and even occasionally, about once every 4 or 5 years, the governor would even feel so upset about it, he'd even mention that this might be having an adverse effect on the native community. But nothing, if you read the historical record of that situation, while the people were concerned about how the state of the caribou, nobody ever said, this is going to destroy a bunch of human beings that live off that caribou. That was at best a political afterthought. I could sit around and do subsistence historical trivia all afternoon, but that is not an exception. That example was really the rule. Now, one of the other interesting things that I've been amused by in terms of the political debate that's gone on in Alaska over these issues is that, based on at least my reading of the historical record, generally speaking, the native community did an unusually good job of paying attention to these idiotic rules that these guys back in Washington, D.C., and then later in Juneau, thought up to control their behavior. One of the things that has always infuriated me about the legal business, in fact, with all due respect to my friend David over there, I was reading part of his latest tome on the state of affairs around here, and one of the things that he remarked is something to the effect of, surely the legal system is not a word game, or something to that effect. And my position was, poor child. I mean, of course it's a word game. I mean, to think that it's not is it's what the whole deal is about. And it is amazing to me that as an act of religion, that non-native regulators, particularly in the 20s and the 30s, would sit around and say, I guess the beaver aren't doing very good anymore, so I guess we'll just shut that down for 3 or 4 years. And then they'd write up on a piece of paper that henceforth nobody should be fooling around with any beaver, and they'd send that out, and then in their own mind, I mean, it's absolute religion, would believe that the 20 or 30,000 human beings would have read this piece of paper, most of whom did not read their language, and would automatically go out and start behaving exactly as these poobahs had indicated on this piece of paper. And what's even more amazing to me is that, generally speaking, they did. I wouldn't have. But it's incredible to read some of this stuff of the 20s and the 30s of particularly missionaries and school teachers, who are obviously people that were communicating with the outside world, saying, we've just had this village meeting for 2 or 3 days, and people are desperate because they can't go beaver trapping anymore and it's going to destroy them, or they can't go caribou hunting or something else, and please, couldn't you change the rules? Well, implicitly, the inference that I draw from that is that people are taking those rules very seriously. And the rules, for the most part, are idiotic. So, I think that is a lot of people, I think, in the political climate of Alaska would now want to give the native community credit for being such good troopers and environmentalists and all this other baloney. I think that they were good troopers personally to a fault. I wouldn't have paid any attention to that gibberish. It was just flatly unjust. So anyway, that's sort of where I see the historical situation as having been. Well, what does all this have to do with ANCSA? Well, what's interesting is that if my analysis that the real problem, when you look at this solely from a regulatory point of view, has been protecting the native community from unfair competition, from being overwhelmed by essentially the non-native community, ANCSA didn't do any more for that situation than anything else that had ever been done. It is fascinating to look at the recommendations of the Land Use Plan, I'm sorry, not the Land Use Planning Committee, the Federal Field Committee, that were eventually transformed into the Senate, the first Senate ANCSA bill, S-1830, I think. Because there is a subsistence provision in there, all right. And what does it say? It authorized but did not require the Secretary of the Interior, if he thought there was an emergency, to close a certain area to the taking of fish or wildlife except to local residents of the area, provided, however, that this emergency could not last for more than, I forget what it was, a couple years. I mean, give me a break. I mean, is that any kind of a commitment to analyzing the social and economic importance of the subsistence system to this day to all of those villages? I mean, ridiculous. And what's also interesting is that there was some poor, sad BIA fellow who came up about the same time and did a report on all of this, and he knew nothing about it. But reading the recommendations in his report, he said that the very first thing you ought to do is you ought to shut down the harvest of fish and wildlife in native regions of the state by every single non-native, non-resident of the area, and only allow it at such time as you have analyzed the base level that is needed to maintain the integrity of the native economic system, and then, and only then, let in whatever it is you can. So it's not to say, and that guy, by the way, was dismissed as essentially a crat who'd come up here in a boondoggle and thrown together a quick study in a couple of weeks and then zip back into non-Alaskan obscurity. But, you know, the point is that at least it's possible that at the time people at least knew or should have known what the problem was. Well, as we all know, even that pathetic protection for the integrity of the native rural economic subsistence system, whatever it is you want to call it, got trashed by the ANCSA conference. And in its place, of course, is the famous, I am told, Dave Hickock language, probably the most often cited bit of legislative history in Alaskan legal history. I'm sure probably most of the people around these tables could chant it like a mantra. You know, anybody want to try it on the count of three, right? You know, we threw this provision in the trash because we think it's unnecessary, because we, the conference committee, think that the secretary already has this authority. And, of course, we expect both the secretary and the state to do everything necessary to take care of this problem. Sincerely yours, the joint conferees. I mean, how many times do we have to listen to that gibberish? I mean, it was, and I don't mean to say that it wasn't worth putting in. It's certainly been very helpful. But I mean, that's past history, and the time for all of that, I think, is over. It doesn't really mean a whole bunch other than nobody thought this problem through. Well, one of the reasons that it got thrown out of the conference committee, of course, was because the state of Alaska showed up and crossed its heart and hoped to die and said, oh, you don't have to do this to us because we really love our natives up there and we'll take care of this whole problem without having to have somebody put thumb screws to all 10 of our fingers. And so we promised to be well behaved. Well, of course, by about 1976, 1977, the amusing hypocrisy associated with that statement had become pretty self-evident. But I would say that the hypocrisy associated with the state of Alaska's representations to the Congress in ANCSA was in the grand tradition of the non-native political system's attitude about this entire issue over the non-native community's entire history of involvement up here. Now, that changed really with the whole political struggle over the subsistence provisions of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, but what I would suggest, getting back to the point of ANCSA, is that to the extent that there has been statutory relief, both on a federal or a state level, it has been directly related, in my judgment, to the ability of the Native community itself to use the political and economic power that ANCSA gave it to protect itself on a policy level. And I think that's one of the things that the Native Claims Settlement Act has really been given not its due about. I mean, I fully understand that to the extent that people thought that ANCSA was to result in more control at a village level in their institutions, in more authentic economic development with respect to village activities, that the Native Claims Settlement Act certainly, if anybody had those expectations, has not fulfilled those expectations. But I would suggest that the Native Claims Settlement Act has done an incredible job of providing the requisite number of poker chips for the Native community to essentially play at the table of public policy with respect to subsistence issues. Without going too deeply into my archives, it's interesting that it is recently as the establishment of the Arctic Wildlife Range that if you go in and look at the historical record on the struggle to establish the wildlife range, after oodles of Senate and House hearings and all kinds of commotion, and Bartlett and all these people were absolutely opposed to the Eisenhower administration withdrawing the range or the Congress establishing the Arctic Range, at the very end of that process, in absolute desperation, with about 15 minutes left in the last hearing, Bob Bartlett says to the representative of the Department of the Interior, well, have you asked any of the members of the Native community who reside in the area what they think about this? And the answer on the hearing record is complete, stunning silence, as if no one had ever thought of that before. Now, that was in 1960. Can you imagine today a proposal by the government to withdraw 8 million acres of land north of the Brooks Range that they would not even come to the table unless they had that deal signed, sealed, and delivered with the North Slope Borough and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and Kaktovik and every other group you could ever think of? That change of circumstance, I would suggest, is not an accident. That it is a direct result of the Native Claims Settlement Act. And I think that in terms of the whole subsistence issue, it is something that the Claims Act is entitled to a little credit for rather than all the baloney that's normally poured over the top of it, or caribou sausage or something. So, you know, it seems to me that with respect to ANCSA, that's sort of where the issue of regulation sits. I'm not going to go into everybody here in some fashion or other from Alaska participated in either the enactment or the implementation of the federal and state subsistence laws, and so we don't need to rehash all of that. That's pretty common knowledge. But I think that in terms of the policy, that it's certainly something to think about. Second thing I'd like to talk about very briefly is this business about the land. I think that I have at least some intellectual disagreement with Tom, who says, at least if I heard your paper correctly, that the most important part about all of this is land ownership or something like control. Land control. Okay, well, see, I think, well, maybe we don't have much of a disagreement. My view on that is that it's use. I think that the Native community, to some extent, has been sucked in by the way that we non-Natives view the legal concepts of land. I mean, land doesn't change. Land's always the same. The only thing that changes are these intellectual systems that we use to describe certain legal relationships among each other. And it was very interesting. I was out in the southwestern part of the state about a year and a half ago at a 1991 meeting, and sort of the people leading this meeting, a regional meeting, stood up and did this whole, the normal the normal sort of ritual about 1991 and protecting the land and blah, 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 and this relatively old stood up. I don't know if I'd want to call him an elder, but he was sort of getting ready to cross over the divide into the world of elders, and he said, hey, you know, I don't know anything about any of this stuff. He says, all I want to be able to do is use it, you know? If I can still hunt and fish on it, nobody else can. I can go out and chop wood whenever I need to, and I can go off and get logs, and if my wife can go berry picking, I don't, you know, all this business about legal title and all the rest of this baloney, I mean, who cares? All I want to be is left alone. I don't care about fee title and all the rest of it. And, you know, I sort of listened to that, and I said, hey, you know, that's a pretty enlightened point of view, really. You know, I mean, it costs a lot of money to own land. So if you have the right rules associated with your use of the land, you know, there's an argument to be made to just shove the ownership responsibilities off on somebody else. And I think there's, to some extent, that was sort of the philosophy about a lot of things that were done with respect to the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. It was, you know, once you got through this bugaboo about how many acres that everybody was falling on their swords, for lack of a more creative metaphor or analogy, you know, once you got through with that, it didn't make any difference where those lines were drawn. What was important would be what were the statutory rules about how people were going to behave inside those boundaries. And so I would suggest that with respect to subsistence and land use, that's really what's important. So let's see. I think that's pretty much about it. We can discuss, if you're interested, the whole relationship between the commercial utilization by the native community of what you would call subsistence resources and how all that might fit into it. But the topic of this panel is really subsistence, which I assume to mean really the use of these resources for personal consumption and keeping them out of the exchange system. So, I mean, I can, however long you'd like me to go on, I'm a professional pontificator on this subject.
Well, I think that while you're at it, you might as well push on to what you described as the conversion of subsistence resources into cash and access to the cash economy. And when you've done that, I think we'll take a break for coffee, and then having heard these three quite different presentations, we can discuss them.
Okay, well, just speaking generally about all of that, to some extent the analysis, I think, holds true into the other side of the equation, which is, I think, the Claims Act has provided economic and political power to also at least assist the Native community in its endeavors with respect to the economic side of things. But it does seem to me that one of the things that the non-Native community seems to forget is that, generally speaking, most people get themselves together to live next door to each other for some reason usually associated with economics. For example, in Youngstown, Ohio, everybody generally built those little houses because they could then all zip down the road with their lunch pails and go to work for whatever it is, U.S. Steel or Young and Laughlin or, you know, whoever it is that is now destroying the place. And, you know, when the economic purpose of Youngstown, Ohio ends, then generally the people will start to dribble away. And certainly the situation has been in Alaska that communities that have been organized in rural Alaska solely around economic activities that no longer exist, and Flat and Iditarod are my two favorite examples, people pack up and move on. Now, I would suggest that the reason that most, but not all, Native communities exist in rural Alaska is because the economic activity that holds those communities together is hunting and fishing in some fashion. Now, we all know the history of that, at least as I understand it as a non-Native, that that people were once scattered around in much smaller units, that it was really the missionaries and the schools that came in and said, unless you people agree to live in a village of a certain size, we're not going to give you the benefits of that school and that church. After all, this is a capital project, you know, and you know how carefully we have to study capital projects in the bush. And so everybody said, boy, we really want these schools and these churches, so we'll stop going to all these other camps and things, and we'll all agree to sit around in this village. But the point is that, discounting for all of that, that generally speaking, most of the communities out there are there because they were convenient locations for people to engage in the harvest of renewable resources. Now, if you also assume, as I said earlier about the Tanana chiefs and the clothes from Seattle, that the fact of the matter is that those communities are dependent in large measure. I mean, sometime the next time you either you go home or you have occasion to visit a village, just walk through with a mental clipboard and look at everything that comes from somewhere else, you know? Sheetrock, insulation, 2x4, snow machines, I mean, the list, you know, on and on and on, electric lights, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. The point is that those things didn't arrive by magic. They all arrived because of the intervention of money. Well, it's also pretty clear to me that most of those communities do not have the amount of money that in any way even remotely reflects the amount of stuff that's been imported in by that economic system. If that's true, it certainly seems to me that it should be rational state and federal policy to encourage the ability of people residing in those communities to participate to the maximum extent possible in whatever authentic economic activities might be available in the area. And I guess I've been cut off again. Still on. I'm still on? Oh. Oh, that's okay.
Your presentation is becoming
too good. Okay. So, you know, the most obvious ways in which that has occurred in the past have been commercial fishing, trapping, and I guess that's really about it. And certainly the commercial use of walrus. Native community never participated, as I understand it, particularly greatly in the commercial use of whales, but I guess probably there was some, right? People taking subsistence caught whales and going to the whaling stations and dealing with that. But I think the history has been that if the non-native community was not particularly inclined to do the native community a favor with respect to the regulation of those resources for what we would call subsistence purposes, the non-native community has been loath to do the native community a favor with respect to the non-subsistence use of those resources. A couple of examples. The whole history of commercial fishing in Southeast Alaska. I mean, it's incredible to me that you look at the historical record and the Fish and Wildlife Service is repeatedly saying, we love fish traps because they're the way to regulate the taking of fish. What the social and economic impacts are, just because that particular method and means happens to benefit all of these capital-intensive Gussics who live in Seattle, rather than literally hundreds if not thousands of Alaska Natives who reside in Southeast Alaska who cannot go seining anymore, is none of our business. I mean, that was essentially their position, is we have no responsibility for social and economic effects of our policies. I would suggest that that was a little bit baloney, that in fact, if you look a little closer at the record, you'll see that they were up to their elbows in at least a, you know, if not a tea dance, at least some kind of jitterbugging with essentially those Seattle capitalists. And we're not about to maximize the native community's participation in that economic activity. You look at the whole situation with the regulation of fur. On the one hand, while For the most part, up until the late 1930s, early 1940s, it was really the native community that had almost exclusive control, even when the Russians were around, of the harvest of those furs, and then they would take them into the capitalists and get 30 cents on the dollar before all the furs were hauled to Seattle. But, you know, when suddenly there was competition for that economic activity, the federal government, which had control in those days, sat on their hands. I mean, you know, one of the reasons that the Venati Reserve exists today has got nothing to do with native sovereignty and all the rest of that stuff. It's got to do with the fact that the BIA, bless their heart, was absolutely petrified about what in the early 40s was happening to folks that lived in Venati and Arctic Village who were getting their trap lines jumped by Gussocks and Super Cubs out of Fairbanks who'd stayed up there after the war. And they went repeatedly to the Alaska Game Commission and to the rest of the department and said, protect these people. But when they said protect them, they didn't mean protect their subsistence activities. They meant protect their economic activities, because you're destroying these people's participation in the non-subsistence economy. That's, David's grinning at me a bit. I've got a whole file on that if you'd ever like to see it sometime. But that's, you know, and the only thing the Bureau had to do to defend those folks was to use its withdrawal authority. But the point is that the traditional means that had political control over that issue were absolutely, completely uncaring at best, and probably exceedingly racist at worst, with respect to protecting not the subsistence economy, but to protect the degree of integration that the native community was able to achieve in the non-native economic system. I guess, you know, the last thing I'd like to say, and then I'll sum up and we can take a break, is that I think that if there's any problem that everybody faces today, and it's certainly something that Gary at least mentioned, it's the continued refusal of many elements of both the non-native community generally and also state and federal resource managers to recognize the significant socio and economic effects that regulatory decisions can have on the rural economy. It is just incredible to me that people can say, well, I don't care what happens to all those people if they pack, you know, if they blow up and drift away. All I want to have is an equal opportunity to go out there and blow away a moose along with everybody else. I mean, completely oblivious and uncaring to the very significant social and economic effect that those decisions have in the aggregate. And frankly, after three quarters of a decade in the business, I have not really the slightest idea what to do about it. I do not think that there has really been an authentic perception on the part of the non-native community about what it is I've just said. I think to the extent that there is a sympathy, and there is an authentic sympathy within wide sections of the non-native community, particularly in the cities, for what they view as subsistence, they don't view it in terms of economic systems. They view it in terms of, well, wouldn't it be nice, you know, they really sort of feel pretty good about the idea that in their state there are these sort of natives that are running around, you know, hauling themselves here and there in dog sleds and drawing fish and stuff, and that's sort of nice, particularly since they don't particularly go out there. Anybody who goes out there, I mean, again, to generalize, but anybody that goes out there and actually competes with the native community for access to those resources, I would say I have not seen them move one iota off of the historical position of everybody for themselves and the social and economic consequences of regulatory actions be damned. So on that very happy note, I guess it's time to head for the coffee pot.
Well, okay, and let's discuss these three presentations after coffee, and we'll all look forward to some good news after coffee.
Remember, give Nelson Frank a chance at some point.
Sure.
Let me find out what.
Yeah,
what
speak to him.